Great. Thanks, Jeff. I would also like to start by thanking the Wilson Center for organizing this great event and for hosting us. So this is an event that is co-sponsored by PRIO, and I would like to also acknowledge financial support from the Research Council of Norway, who is actually funding several climate security projects hosted at PRIO, and one of which is sort of the origin for this event. It's an honor to be part of such a distinguished panel. Very much looking forward to listening to the other speakers, and of course to the conversation around the room. So in my response to the very general question about what can we tell about climate conflict connections from the scientific literature, I will draw on one particular literature that consists of statistical or quantitative research that are comparative in nature, meaning research that strives for drawing more general conclusions about the connection between climatic changes of various kinds and conflict of various kinds. This is the literature that I'm most familiar with myself. It is also the literature that I've contributed most to, and I believe it is also the literature that is most relevant when we discuss security impacts of climatic changes in the short to medium term. I'll get back to some limitations as we go along. All right, so I'll make five general observations related to what we can tell from scientific research on climatic changes and conflict. And the first observation is that climate is unquestionably linked to armed conflict. If we produce a map of the world with locations of ongoing and recently ended armed conflicts, and we superimpose on that map different climate zones or climatic regions, we would very easily see a distinct clustering patterns of armed conflicts in warmer climates. And in fact, if we compare countries that have seen at least one civil conflict since 1950, if we compare the climatic conditions of those countries with at least one civil conflict since 1950, with those countries that have remained at peace in every year since 1950, we would see that the conflict-affected countries, on average, are 8 degrees Celsius warmer, that is 13 degrees Fahrenheit warmer, than the average peaceful country. We can talk about all sorts of caveats, and I'll be happy to talk more about that during the Q&A with this very simplistic comparison. Also, if we look at climate zones, we would see that the frequency of armed conflict among countries in the dry climate zone is 10 times higher than the frequency of conflict in countries in the continental climate zone. So those are remarkable statistics, and those would make for very interesting maps. At the same time, associations like this in space and time cannot be used to draw claims about causal relationships. And I would actually very strongly warn against doing that. Even so, we often see maps like this used to motivate causal claims. So while there clearly is a connection or an association in space and time between certain climatic conditions and higher frequency of conflict, that in itself does not indicate a causal connection. Okay. That's my first observation. Secondly, climatic changes are also linked to armed conflict. There have been a number of recent World Bank Commission studies, including some conducted by colleagues at PRIO, that successfully demonstrate that armed conflict effectively is development in reverse. It's a major barrier to economic growth. And conflict has also been identified as the main cause of failures to meet the Millennium Development Goals. And to just give an example, The World Food Programme now spends 80% of its resources in conflict-affected areas. And so it's impossible, really, to imagine societies with sustained and sustainable growth while simultaneously hosting armed conflict. So armed conflicts do not cause climatic changes by themselves, conflict is an important cause of vulnerability to climatic changes. And in that sense, the imagined world map of an overlap between certain climatic conditions and a high risk of conflict could, in fact, partly also capture a causal relationship, not necessarily between climatic conditions moving on to conflict risk, but perhaps more from conflict to increased vulnerability, and if you overlay that with harsh environmental conditions, an increased risk of continuation of violence. So that is my second observation. Third, and this is more of a question that I will try to respond very briefly, is climate change or climatic changes of various types in time and nature, can they also be a cause of armed conflict? And here, I think the very simple response would be a qualified maybe. There is emerging evidence to suggest that climatic changes can affect the dynamics of conflict. And by dynamics, I mean duration, the likelihood of a peaceful ending within a short time period, severity of conflict. There is emerging scientific evidence to suggest that extreme weather events, in particular, can make conflict resolution harder. It can make it easier for rebel organizations to recruit soldiers and generally affect the dynamics of conflicts in various ways. At the same time, there is no scientific consensus that suggests that climatic changes can cause the outbreak of new conflicts. That doesn't mean that it cannot happen in certain cases or that climatic phenomena cannot influence processes that eventually lead to conflict in particular cases. But if you look at many cases of conflict over time and space, there is no general pattern that has been detected that suggests a robust and general effect from climatic changes to the outbreak of new conflicts. That said, there is general scientific agreement that climatic changes can also contribute to increasing risk of conflict under certain conditions through certain causal pathways and mechanisms and end up in certain forms of conflict. But here is where the research frontier really is at the moment, trying to identify what are those causal mechanisms. Are we talking about increased food insecurity, loss of economic growth, livelihoods, forced migration, et cetera. And I hope that, or I believe Josh maybe will be reflecting on some of those potential pathways. But yet, the state of the art, as I read it, is that we still haven't really arrived at a firm understanding of exactly what those conditions would be that increases the likelihood of conflict under climatic changes and through what mechanisms we are more likely to see such effects materialize. In addition, we need to factor in the fact that common drivers of conflict, and by that I mean a history of violence, low level of development, poor governance, discrimination, horizontal or intergroup inequalities in both economic and political terms. Many of those underlying and what I would argue more immediate and more important drivers of conflict, many of them can also be sensitive to climatic changes. And that suggests that maybe we are dealing here with more complex, but possibly also more subtle linkages between climatic changes and some form of conflict outcome further down the line. So there are valid concerns about how climatic changes may affect conflict. There is emerging evidence to suggest that the dynamics, the severity, the duration of conflict is sensitive to climatic changes. But in line with the IPCC Fifth Assessment Report that was published 4 years ago, as of yet, there isn't evidence of a general and robust connection between climatic changes and the outbreak of new conflict. And that is my third observation. Moving on, and I'm taking my time. We need to acknowledge certain limitations in this literature that I'm drawing these insights from. First of all, there is an apparent disconnect between much of the policy debate, which really deals with climate change, and by that I mean long-term decadal changes in environmental conditions, perhaps permanent changes, and the empirical climate conflict research literature that really focuses on climate variability or short-term fluctuations in weather patterns and the occurrence of extreme weather events. Now, there are good reasons why research focuses on climate variability. It's easier to attribute, or at least to identify correlates that happens within a limited time and space frame. And there are also reasons why social responses to climate variability have implications for social responses to climate change further down the line. At the same time, there are also certain reasons why we should perhaps be a little bit careful about drawing a one-to-one association between how societies respond to an unusually warm summer and how they will respond to a 2-degree warmer world. A second limitation that I wanted to mention is a certain level of attention bias. And that is certainly not limited to the scientific literature, but it also affects the scientific literature. And by attention bias, I mean a tendency to focus on cases that have experienced conflict and typically also experienced extreme weather events or certain climatic anomalies. And then we investigate to what extent can those anomalies have caused or have contributed to causing those conflicts. Now, that research is interesting and it's valuable. But focusing only on cases that includes conflict doesn't make for good generalizations. We also need to understand, we need to study dogs that don't bark, societies that regularly experience extreme weather events, that regularly experience or have experienced gradual and sustained degradation, for example, but where we do not observe a violent outcome. In order to properly understand how climatic changes and insecurity may be connected, we need to focus on the full spectrum here. And so that's a limitation of the research, as I see it. And the third and final limitation that I wanted to mention is that the literature that I'm drawing on here, which really deals with the most common form of conflicts that we are observing today, civil conflicts and to some extent communal violence, that literature may have limited relevance when we are really looking into the long-term future. Looking out the window and observing the weather today is a pretty good indication of how the weather is tomorrow. And it's a little bit like that when we also think about the security situation in the world. The world in 2019 is likely not going to be radically different from the world in 2018. And so for that reason, I think that the scientific literature that I'm drawing my comments on are relevant for saying more about likely developments in the short-term future, potentially also into a few decades into the future. But when we're talking about climate change over the next 50 to 80 years, everything is going to be so different. How the world was in 1950 is quite different from today. And our models in 1950 wouldn't be very good at predicting the situation today. And so I think we need to acknowledge the limitation of this research when we are talking about security impacts of a 3-degree warmer world. So these are important limitations. There are other limitations, but I'm not going to mention them here. I do not want to suggest that those caveats should be used to dismiss the relevance or the merit of this research. I certainly do believe that this research is important. But it should serve as a reminder of the boundaries of the applicability of this research. And obviously, it also should serve as a guidance for where to move forward as researchers. And then fifth, to conclude, I'll make just three brief points before moving on. First, while we should not underestimate the importance of addressing climatic changes and long-term climate change and global warming, I urge us all to exercise restraint when making claims about conflict potential of those climatic changes in the absence of rigorous scientific evidence. Climate change is sufficiently worrying by itself that we need not add unwarranted claims to stir action. Also, if ending ongoing conflicts is our key concern, or if preventing conflict from breaking out in societies that presently are at high risk, there are very likely to be other initiatives, other policies that are more effective in ending those conflicts or in preventing those potential conflicts from breaking out than addressing environmental conditions on the ground. So climatic changes can spark conflict only where the breeding ground is right. And so if we fix the breeding ground, a drought may not necessarily have massive impacts on the risk of armed conflict. Second, climate change adaptation in conflict-affected societies, and by that I also include more general development and emergency aid to conflict-affected societies, may not necessarily have a huge impact on the likelihood of ending that conflict. I think there are political issues that is very likely to be much more important in ending those conflicts. But adaptation and development can be very important in lessening the human cost of that conflict or those conflicts, and thereby also perhaps have some positive long-term impact on the likelihood of peace. And third, ending armed conflict is the most effective strategy to lower the human consequences of climate change and to create facilities compatible with sustained growth. So that means more investments in diplomacy and addressing those fundamental drivers of armed conflict. So if I can summarize in two sentences, and we can take the discussion from there, climate change mitigation, while good and important for many, many reasons, as I see it, has an unclear effect on future conflict risk in the short to medium term. Conflict mitigation, or ending conflict, in contrast, is probably the most important thing we can do to reduce environmental vulnerability. Thanks.